It teaches you about the whole world. I see my grandchildren collecting these stupid Japanese stickers, little trinkets, forgotten the name, but they're so expensive and so pointless compared with stamps. You can start collecting stamps for free, just by steaming them off envelopes. I also told her about my bad experience as a stamp investor, which rather soured my love affair. Oh, I've heard that story all the time. It did such damage to the whole stamp world. Harold and I never sold investment portfolios in our own shop, so our customers did not get caught when the slump came. On the other hand, in good times, we, of course, gained by prices going up. At the moment, during this period of recession, stamps, strangely enough, have kept and even increased their value. That's what our son Mike tells us. He now runs the Bath stamp shop. It's nothing to do with us anymore. We just do the museum. After a couple of hours' chat, we went back to the museum and Audrey gave me a conducted tour. There appeared to be no other visitors, though by this time it was early afternoon. I had been prepared to mock the audio-visual stuff Audrey had been going on about, but it turned out to be more useful, relevant and tasteful than I had feared. There are several short films about the history of writing, one of which is narrated by Richard Briers. He did it for nothing, as a favour. It could have cost us £30,000 otherwise. There are also two portraits of 18th-century Barthonian gentlemen in gold frames, which spring to life when you touch them, speaking from the frame itself, telling you who they were and their importance. Very cleverly done. The first one was Ralph Allen, who in 1720 was the first person to set up a system of cross-country posts which did not go via London, as all previous postal services had done. He paid the post office £6,000 a year for the contract, an enormous sum, about half a million today, and ran the inland postal system right to the borders of Scotland from his office in Bath. It didn't make him a profit for 7 years, but then it came good, giving him enough money to invest in local quarries, the ones used to build Georgian Bath. He ended up very wealthy, with a massive country estate. John Palmer had an equally good idea, creating a system of very fast coaches which eventually carried the Royal Mail all over the country. In his case, he didn't become a millionaire on the proceeds, even though his Royal Mail coaches revolutionised communication. It was 15 years before the post office repaid him for financing the entire project. Postal history does have its heroes and entrepreneurs and innovators, just as computers do today. Another eminent Barthonian connected to postal reform was Thomas Musgrave, Bath postmaster from 1833 to 1854. He was responsible for posting the first ever penny black, which he sent from Bath on the 2nd of May, 1840. He was, of course, jumping the gun, as the first day of issue was officially the 6th of May, as every schoolboy collector used to know. The cover, with the stamp and date and postal marking clearly to be seen, came up for auction at Harmer's in London in 1990. Audrey went along to bid, knowing this was just the sort of prime treasure with Bath connections that would do wonders for the postal museum, but she failed to get it. It went for £55,000. It was an agent who bought it, whom I didn't recognise. I grabbed him afterwards to ask who he was bidding for, but he wouldn't tell me. We still don't know who owns it, apart from that it is someone in the Far East. If it ever came on the market again, it would probably fetch a million. Other well-known Barthonians and events featured in the museum include Henry Cole, who devised the first Christmas card in 1843, and the first 100-mile airmail flight, which went from Bath to London in 1912. The museum also has a collection of different letterboxes, including one that used to be attached to tram cars, so that passengers could post their letters while travelling, plus franking and perforating machines. One large display is given over to 4,000 years of communication, from clay tablets carrying messages from Mesopotamia, around 2000 BC, through papyrus letters from Egypt, right up to the present day with mobile phones. which enables the display to have the racy title Clay Mail to E-Mail. I found the history of the mail coach very interesting, how they were allowed to race through toll gates, paying no tolls. A team of horses at a coaching inn had to be changed in 6 minutes max in order to adhere to the timetable. The post horn could be heard miles away, heralding its arrival. Coach travel was, of course, hellishly uncomfortable, with lots of terrible accidents as they clattered along at speeds of up to 15 miles per hour on potholed roads. One of the pleasant surprises to me was that the museum doesn't really have a lot of stamps or even postal covers. Stamps can be a bit boring for the uncommitted. In fact, it is mainly filled with objects, original artifacts to do with communication over the centuries. Audrey had boasted that once inside, children do love it, which I had doubted, but now I could believe it. She is not too worried about the future of the museum. She feels there is a strong and knowledgeable board of trustees and supporters who will be able to run it long after she and Harold have gone. None of their own 6 children or 11 grandchildren wants to be involved in the museum, and only one is interested in stamps, and he, Mike, has his own shop to run. The others went into a variety of careers: refrigerated vehicles, landscape gardening, music, art, and journalism. She must feel proud, having helped create such a museum on a subject she knew nothing about till she got married and seen it through all its various problems and struggles. "I think the best thing about it has been the fun, not the pride. We have had so many wonderful events, and I've met so many interesting people and made so many friends through the museum. It's given me a wonderful life." So, that's another reason for creating a museum. With a bit of luck, the world comes to you. Naturally, you have to be the right sort of person in the first place to want to meet the world, which not all collectors are. Having been prejudiced against audio-visual nonsenses and interactive How's Your Fathers, I was quite impressed by some of her bits of modern techno-magic, particularly the portraits that come to life and start talking. I can see all ages finding that interesting. Most of all, though, I was impressed by Audrey's promotional and PR skills, considering there was nothing in her background or training along those lines. She just did it. Now, should I hire a helicopter or an old stagecoach for the opening of my museum? Do I know any DJs or TV stars? My wife and I did get invited, for some reason I never worked out, to a Buckingham Palace garden party several years ago. We never had her back. Very rude. I know. When I get my museum organised, I'll invite the Queen to tea and to have a look at my treasures. That should make a few lines in the local paper. On the way back to Bath Spa station, I met an old woman in her 80s who looked like Mrs. Tiggywinkle. I thought at first she might be a bag lady, till I realised she was struggling with her shopping. I asked her if I was on the right way to the railway station, and she insisted on walking there with me, explaining that the roadworks were to do with a new bus station, which she hated, having campaigned against its design as it was not in keeping with Bath. Absolute disgrace. I told her I'd been to visit the Bath Postal Museum, and she asked if I'd gone to the Museum of East Asian Art, as that was really excellent. She had worked there as a volunteer and loved it. She sounded, from her accent and appearance, as if she had always lived and worked around Bath, so I wondered how she had become interested in Eastern art. "Oh, I started collecting it when I was working in New York for the World Bank. I was in external affairs, PA to a director. The friend I shared an apartment with had lots of ancient Chinese plates, which we ate off. I've been round the whole world, you know, on my own. Took a year, travelling with just one suitcase to Afghanistan, Thailand, everywhere. My family are always telling me I should write my life story, it's been so interesting." "You should," I said, "or at least get it down on tape for your grandchildren." "Oh, I've got no children or grandchildren, I'm not married. But I'm still hoping." She offered to sit with me till my London train came, but hers was just leaving, a local train to Westbury, so I bade her farewell and good luck. Working in a museum, even if it's just voluntary work, is also a way of meeting the world and having a social life. During those 10 years madly collecting stamps, I did make friends with many dealers, went to fairs, big and small, and exhibitions, and joined various clubs and societies. It was an amusing distraction, kept me off the streets, till one day I woke up and said, "What am I doing? What's the point of all this?" I was still buying stamps, but not looking at them, just shoving them in drawers. There's not a lot to look at anyway. I prefer items with more content, such as books, comics, postcards, letters, leaflets, magazines, which is why I've found myself with 20 or so other collections on different topics, including the suffragettes, first editions, the Lake District, the home front. Most of all, I realised there were two areas where I really did feel actively passionate and genuinely interested, and also, I like to think, vaguely knowledgeable. That's when I decided to chuck in the stamps, sell up, even at a loss, and move on. I would concentrate on my other collections from now on, and on those two main ones in particular. Would I find museums devoted to them as I wandered around? Or perhaps museums on topics I would never have imagined could possibly exist? Bath Postal Museum, 27 Northgate Street, Bath, BA1 1AJ, telephone 01225 460-333. www.bathpostalmuseum.co.uk. Chapter 4. The Baked Bean Museum of Excellence, Port Talbot. For about an hour, Captain Beanie would not let me see his museum, keeping me talking in what he calls his interview room. I was beginning to think it was all a nonsense. I'd been conned by a joker or a fantasist, and the museum, if and when I was eventually allowed to see it, would be empty, or perhaps contain just one can of beans. Ha ha! Perhaps, after all, I should have gone to the National Coracle Centre, up in Kenarth Falls in Carmarthenshire. That was on my list as another unusual Welsh museum devoted to just one subject, but it sounded a bit worthy and institutional, and also there didn't seem to be one person, one collector, behind it, which is what I had decided I was looking for, apart from unusual contents. And Captain Beanie's collection did sound pretty unusual. After stamps, the most obvious, popular and longest established of our modern-day collectibles, baked beans would certainly be a bit different. I had spoken to Captain Beanie on the phone, and he sounded real enough, and looking at his website, I saw he had had an official opening of his Baked Bean Museum of Excellence in January 2009 with a well-known TV and radio personality. So it said, though I didn't recognise the name, but that doesn't mean anything. I wouldn't recognise most TV stars if I met them in my porridge. I also noted he was a member of the Association of Independent Museums, which was a good sign. On the phone, he had asked if I wanted him to dress up. "For what?" "For my visit," he said. "Don't bother. I'll just be wearing my usual old rags." "Okay, good," he replied. "I won't have to put on my Captain Beanie costume then." Which he had not. He was wearing jeans, an old shirt and a woolly hat, which he kept on all the time. Aged 50-ish, thin, slender, pale but fit-looking. Having said I am not up on TV stars, he did remind me of that bloke in the Fast Show who runs down the street shouting, "Brilliant!" He laughed all the time, which was a bit disconcerting, partly because I found his Welsh accent rather hard to follow, and also because I couldn't always quite work out what he was laughing at. I decided it was nervous laughter, to put me or himself at ease. And yet, looking round at all the photos and certificates and newspaper cuttings on the walls of his very neat and tidy interview room, he has clearly received many visitors over the years. TV crews from as far afield as Korea have traipsed to his little council flat in South Wales to capture what they believe to be a true British eccentric who has developed a passion for baked beans. In Korean homes, he's probably better known than our Prime Minister. But then, we do much the same, All countries love fancy-that human interest stories about funny people abroad doing funny things. Captain Beanie lives in Port Talbot on the top floor of a three-storey 1960s council block on an estate called Sandfields. Not scary or vandalised, just a bit sad and worn out. Port Talbot itself is pretty sad these days, having been for generations one of the industrial powerhouses of South Wales. On one side of the estate, there used to be a massive BP chemical works, now gone, while the other way you came to the steelworks, which employed 12,000 people only 20 years ago. Still going, but now Indian-owned, and with barely 3,000 workers. Captain Beanie lives alone in his two-bedroom flat. He originally lived here with his mother, nursing her till she died. He's turned his living room into the interview room, and the main bedroom is now his museum. But before opening up, he was insisting I had a good look at his personal memorabilia and heard the stories behind them. He wasn't born Captain Beanie, surprisingly enough. He was born Barry Kirk in 1954, and at school he was always known as Captain after the Starship Enterprise's Captain Kirk. Aged five, at primary school I used to sit at my desk with plastic specs on and a false moustache. I remember one day another teacher coming into the class and remarking on the fact that the other kids were not looking at me. She was told by our class teacher that I was always like that, so everyone was used to me. I suppose I was trying to draw attention to myself. I did funny voices all the time and impressions. At secondary school I did join the drama class, thinking it would be great having an audience, which it was. But I couldn't learn my lines. I hated having to work from a script. I have the attention span of a goldfish. So that was that. I felt I was a thespian inside. Ha ha, but it would never come out. I wouldn't be able to find a channel. I presumed I'd therefore end up putting away the false moustache, get a mundane job, get married and have 2.5 kids. The mundane job part came true, and he had a sequence of them when he left school, armed with 5 O-levels. He reeled them off, almost having hysterics at the memory of each one. British Constitution, can you believe it? I have an O-level in British Constitution. Brilliant. I also got art and design, drama, RE and pottery. Can you believe pottery? For 4 years, he worked not far away at the DVLA office in Swansea as a machine operator. Then he moved to Surrey as a sign writer, returning home to Port Talbot and his mum to work on a computer at the BP Chemical Works, where he stayed from 1978 to 1992, when he was offered redundancy. While working there, he started doing a lot of charity work, going on sponsored walks, helping good causes. His moment of epiphany, his life-changing moment, or at least what became his name-changing moment, occurred on the 11th of September, 1986. He got up to examine the framed photographs and cuttings of the event which happened that day, just to check the precise date, which of course he knew all along. I had read somewhere that someone had got into the Guinness Book of Records for lying in a bath of custard for 24 hours. Then I heard someone had sat in a bath of spaghetti for 50 hours. I was wondering what I could do when I thought, I know baked beans. I lie in a bath full of them for 100 hours. It wasn't quite the totally original piece of inspiration you might imagine. He says he pinched the idea from The Who. He scurried off to find one of their old LPs called The Who Sell Out, on the cover of which is a photo of Roger Daltrey in a bath of baked beans. It looks, to me, suspiciously like a photo montage, but the seed was sown. Barry got sponsorship from people all over Port Talbot. Heinz, alas, ignored his appeals for help, or at least free beans, but a local businessman paid for 360 tins. Another provided a bath, which was set up in the foyer of the Aberavon Hotel. He got in, naked but for his swimming trunks, and children had to pay £1 to pour one can of beans over his head. In 4 hours, all the tins had been emptied, and the bath was full. It's strange what the human body can endure. I got a shock with the cold at first, but then I got used to it. Someone gave me a board, which I put across the bath, and laid my head on it and got about 4 hours' sleep that night. But 100 hours is 4 nights. I was exhausted, unshaven, and very tired by the end, but I got massive publicity from TV and radio and the papers. I did create a record and got a certificate. Look, on the shelf, from the Guinness Book of Records. Best of all, I raised £1,500, which I gave to a local mental handicap charity. I'd thought that would be the end, my last charity stunt, but for days afterwards, kids were following me in the street saying, "Look, there's the Bean Man." I began to think I could turn him into a character. I thought of my childhood nickname, Captain, added it to Bean, and then made it Beanie, as two syllables flowed better, and out came Captain Beanie. I saw him as a superhero from a Marvel comic. He had come from the planet Venus to help human beings. So after that, when I did other charity stunts, I dressed up as Captain Beanie in an orange jumpsuit and cape. In 1992, I legally changed my name. I went to a solicitor and asked him to do it. He laughed so much he let me off the £80 he should have charged. Then I went to Lloyd's Bank with the documents and said, "My name is now Captain Beanie. Can I have a credit card in that name?" They laughed as well, but I got one. I even changed my passport. Look, here it is. It's in the name of Captain Beanie. My driving license is as well. Oh, if I only had a car. Since 1992, he has run about 20 marathons all over the world, including Boston, Los Angeles, New York, Dublin, Brussels, and 7 London marathons, each time as Captain Beanie, carrying a plate of beans on toast all the way round. I love marathons, and I'm now getting ready for the next London one. The spectators are my audience, that's why I love them. Over the last 20 years, he reckons, he has raised over £100,000 for charity. He has stood for 7 elections, local and national, as Captain Beanie. "I stood in one general election against the late screaming Lord Such, God bless his soul, but he did better than me. In one local election I got 139 votes, beating the Lib Dem candidate who only got 124. She was so disappointed she gave up politics and never stood again." On his walls he has certificates awarded to Captain Beanie, medals won by Captain Beanie, the planet Venus officially registered in his name by an American star-naming company, and an insurance policy that guarantees to pay Captain Beanie £1 million in the event that he is A. abducted by aliens, B. impregnated by aliens, or C. consumed by aliens. He says it's from a genuine insurance company who agreed to it as a stunt, though they have since gone bust. On the 1st of April 2009, he was honoured by the Eccentric Club in London and received the 2009 Great Britain Eccentric Award. Oh, what larks! But I was getting desperate, becoming convinced it was all just a silly, if harmless, stunt to attract attention, that the so-called museum room would be empty, just full of space, ha-ha. But eventually, he got on to the origins of the museum. "About 10 years ago, as part of my Captain Beanie character, I started collecting items to do with baked beans. I've always liked them, lived on them for years, really, so I went on eBay and began buying any unusual beanie items. When I got a few dozen, I decided to put them all in one room and call it the Baked Bean Museum, and I painted all the walls orange. Then I thought, I have to do this properly. I don't want anything tacky, so I contacted a professional designer and he got me some proper display shelves made of perspex and glass, shatterproof glass in case any tins of beans explode. They weren't cheap. In fact, he charged me £1,500 just for the shelves. I think he saw me coming. I've been letting visitors see my museum for the last 7 years, such as TV crews and parties of students. There's a Captain Beanie Appreciation Society at the University of Aberystwyth, bless them, which has 560 members on Facebook. But the museum has never been officially opened. I was waiting for a celeb to arrive and cut the ribbon, but no one appeared. I was hoping for an A-list celeb, such as Anthony Hopkins, the actor. He comes from round here, you know, as did Richard Burton. We also have Catherine Jenkins and Michael Sheen, the actor who played Tony Blair. No, I didn't approach any of them. I just waited, thinking someone will arrive, present themselves, perhaps from another planet. In the end, Danny Wallace materialized. You haven't heard of him? Oh, he's very famous. He rang up one day to say he was doing a TV series about eccentric people and wanted to do a programme about me. So I asked him when he was here to cut the ribbon, and he also unveiled a plaque. I've put him in my Haricot Hall of Fame. Come on, I'll show you. At long last, we went into the hall, and I admired his Hall of Fame. It consists of Polaroid photos of all the TV crews and media people and groups who have been to see him and his museum over the years. Finally, with a lot of pretend blowing of trumpets, he opened the bedroom door marked Baked Bean Museum of Excellence. He added the "of excellence" for the opening ceremony, thinking that, as he had waited so long, it was bound to be really excellent by now. The door was thrown open wide, but I couldn't see much at first, as the window blind was down. It was quite dark till he switched on the light. I expected to be underwhelmed, though ready to make polite noises and affect delight, but I have to say I was really impressed. It is indeed what he had said it was, a baked bean museum. It is a whole room, full of display units, neatly ordered and arranged, totally devoted to baked beans. The blind is kept down, as he doesn't want sunlight to enter and perhaps affect his treasures. And the radiator is always off. Some of the cans are still full, so I wouldn't like them to overheat and start ponging. That could upset the neighbours. The display units do look very professional, self-standing, about 6 feet high, in white with glass shelves, arranged in a logical order as you proceed round the room. On the top shelf of the first unit is a collection of Mr. Bean merchandising. A slight cheat, I suppose, as his character is not directly connected to beans, but permissible. It includes film stills of Mr. Bean toy cars, videos, clocks, dolls, and a signed photo of Rowan Atkinson as Mr. Bean. He paid £25 for this on eBay. I was surprised to see how many merchandising products and spin-offs there had been from Mr. Bean. Captain Beanie obviously thinks so as well. He's a bit jealous that his own character has not yet spawned as many. However, on a shelf below, he has a collection of Captain Beanie merchandising which he himself has created for his own character. Not quite as numerous, and some of the stuff looked a bit homemade, but the Captain Beanie keyrings and fridge magnets appeared professional enough. Next, you come to a most interesting and extensive collection of American items, all to do with the origins of what we now call baked beans, which, as Captain Beanie tried to explain, began in Boston, hence the fact that they are often still called Boston baked beans. When the Puritans arrived in Boston, or was it the Pilgrims, he couldn't quite remember, but a lot of them were very religious and wouldn't do any cooking on Sunday. So every Saturday they would make a big pot of beans, perhaps throw in some pork, and that would be the dish eaten on Sundays. Lots of different manufacturers of baked beans set up in New England and then throughout the USA, most of which I had never heard of, such as Bush baked beans, Grandma Brown's baked beans, M&B baked beans, and the Old Fart Baked Bean Company. Along with examples of their produce, like any good museum curator, he has also collected their associated advertising and merchandising. Dolls, jigsaws, plates, bean pots, tea towels, bed warmers, space hoppers, postcards, frisbees and clocks, all to do with the various baked bean producers, complete with their logos. "Look at this clock. It keeps Greenwich bean time." Moving round, I came to collections of European baked beans, with tins and other items from countries like Germany and Holland, and also Britain. In his British display area, there is a tin of Biber baked beans. I remember going round Biber in the 70s, wondering at all the amazing clothes, and my wife still has a pair of purple canvas boots from there. All I kept was a Biber plastic bag and Biber bill, but I don't remember them doing their own baked beans or any sort of processed food. "Wow," I said. "You've got an unusual piece of modern British consumer history." "Well, I had to pay £40 for it. The most I've ever paid for a tin of beans. Lots of people were after it because it's an iconic label." There was another British baked bean I had somehow also missed, one sold at Asda. This was baked beans in chocolate sauce. Ugh. Yes, that was what most people thought. It was taken off the shelves after about one day, so it's very hard to find. Again, I bought it on eBay. His British section includes quite a few items related to HP baked beans, which he says is the only truly British manufacturer. One of his most touching HP items is a set of cufflinks, still in their presentation box, with the engraved message, "Cufflinks presented for 20 years service to HP Baked Beans, Wisbeach, Cambridgeshire." Just think of the poor soul who got them, knocking himself out all those years on a baked bean production line, and all he gets is a pair of measly cufflinks. Poor bugger, bless him, whoever he was. The biggest single display in his whole museum is, naturally enough, devoted to Heinz Beans, which is, of course, a US company, though they have been manufacturing in England since 1886, according to the centenary booklets in his collection. He has a vast range of all their different sizes and types of tins, plus aprons, tea towels, soft toys. When they decided to start spelling the name Heinz Beans, he had to start again getting all the same sorts of items, only with a Z. Ah, once you become a collector, it never stops. He has a copy, not the original, of an historic photo that shows Herbert Ponting, a member of Captain Scott's Antarctic expedition in 1911, sitting in a snowy wasteland on top of a box on which you can clearly read the words Heinz Beans. How's that for product placement? Most of his baked beans-related stuff has been bought quite cheaply because, so he says, there is no one else collecting it. I told him this was his fantasy. There will be dozens of others out there, there always are, only he hasn't met them yet. But it does appear old tins of baked beans are very inexpensive if you can find them. He has also been given a lot of stuff by people clearing their shelves. Tins of old beans are, I suppose, a bit awkward, not to say worrying, to keep. But as with that Bieber tin, he often finds himself up against more mainstream collectors who are after the same objects, but for different reasons, which puts up the prices. This happens particularly with things like Dinky and Corgi toys, which include delivery lorries for various baked bean firms. He has, for instance, 30 different examples of Heinz Beans die-cast vehicles still in their original packaging, which is how all true collectors want them. They were not cheap. The single most expensive item in his whole museum is a Dinky super toy of a Heinz lorry from the 1960s, which cost him £200. I reckoned, looking round his museum, that he has about 500 different items, though he himself wasn't sure. He clearly dusts them, as they were all sparkling, but he doesn't count them. Nor has he labelled them, tut-tut, which all good curators should do, though as he only does one-to-one tours, he does his own commentary. Overall, he thinks, he has not spent more than £1,000 so far on the actual contents of his collection, making the glass display shelves still the single biggest outlay. So where does he get his money from? He doesn't appear to have had any sort of job since 1992 when he was made redundant from BP, though he does live simply and frugally and has no family to support. "When I took the redundancy money and ran, I did have enough to live on for a while and was able to buy things for my baked beans collection. I did apply for jobs, but I didn't get them, so I was entitled to benefits. I began to realise that one of the problems about my getting any sort of work was being called Captain Beanie. When people saw that was my name, they didn't want to know, thinking I'd be a weirdo. So, yes, I was on benefits for a long time, which allowed me to do all the work for charity, raising money. But 4 years ago, I went self-employed. I am now technically a small trading company. And what I am trading in is Captain Beanie merchandising. Every so often, I order about 2,000 or so Captain Beanie keyrings, fridge magnets and dolls made to my design, and try to sell them. I don't charge people to look at my museum, but I hope they might buy some of the goods as souvenirs. It means that for the last 4 years I have not taken any benefits. So how many people visit his museum in a year? Oh, I'd like to say tens of thousands, but the truth is probably around 100 or so a year, always by appointment. He would, of course, have a bit of a problem with his local council if the museum became a professional concern, and probably also with his neighbours if queues and cars suddenly started appearing outside and people were traipsing up the communal stairs to his flat, though he does seem to be well-loved and popular in the area. He would ideally like more space for his museum and more money to buy more items, but even if he were to win the lottery and own his own big house, he doesn't think he would open up his museum to the general public. He doesn't have that sort of yearning. Captain Beanie, he fondly hopes, will one day become a public figure, a character taken up by comics and films. But his actual museum is more of a private thing, an act of love and devotion to a persona he has created to save himself from, well, whatever has been troubling him in his life. He did hint at various problems and dramas he has had, mainly to do with the death of his mother and a younger brother. His relentless public cheerfulness would appear to be a cover for something or other, though he rarely let it slip. If nothing else, Captain Beanie has probably saved him from boredom and depression, given him an audience and a purpose when life otherwise had not given him very much. "Captain Beanie did take over my life. No one knew who I was till then, but it has begun to feel as if I have a dual personality. I'm now going back more to being Barry Kirk as well. 2 years ago, Barry Kirk became a born-again Christian. Barry now goes to church, an evangelical one in Port Talbot, but Captain Beanie, he has not yet seen the light. Coming from planet Venus, he has his own bean of light." His mobile phone rang, which rather alarmed me because all I could hear was a disembodied voice echoing round the room. "Planet Venus to planet Earth, please communicate. Captain Beanie, are you there? Require your immediate assistance." He then had hysterics at his own wits and cleverness, letting it ring and ring, doubled up with laughter, before answering the call from a friend. He created the ringtone himself, as of course in his working life he was quite handy with computers and technical stuff, which you will see if you study his website. It is the only ringtone he has, so when it rings in public places like the post office, strangers are very surprised, much to his delight. "I love their surprised expressions, but I carry on as Captain Beanie, saying, 'Captain Beanie here.' Then I say I must go off into a private corner to take an urgent message." He insisted on coming back to town with me in my taxi, wanting to show me where he normally sets up his museum souvenir shop. Every museum, of any size or sort, national or private, has to have a souvenir shop. Some are often as big as the museum itself, for this is how they attempt to make an income, apart from entry fees. By the unusual nature of his museum, and having it located in a council flat, he is a bit limited when it comes to cash flow. As we wandered round Port Talbot's shopping centre, he pointed out all the shops and stores where the owners or managers allow him to set up a little stall for a few hours at the weekend. He sits there, selling Captain Beanie keyrings and magnets and dolls to local families and kids. Everywhere we went, people did smile when they saw him, shouted over and said, "Hi, Captain, hello, Beanie." He does seem to give pleasure to people, and he has raised all that money for charity. There was a friendliness about the town, despite a rather deprived, run-down feeling, the sort of ordinary, rather impoverished, pound-shop kind of place that only ever makes the national headlines when something awful happens there, or something wonderful. Which, in fact, did happen, the month after I had been to see Captain Beanie. In November 2009, a couple from Port Talbot, the man unemployed with £68 overdrawn at the bank, won the astounding sum of £45.5 million on the Euro Millions lottery. I felt a bit jealous. Not of the money, certainly not. I won the lottery when I met my wife. But of the copy. I did a book about the National Lottery when it started, following the winners of 10 jackpots over the first year after their win. The biggest win amongst my lot, in fact for many years to come, was 22 million. Piddling, really. I don't think Captain Beanie would be jealous either. He seemed content with how he had his museum, what he had done in his own modest way, and probably wouldn't want a few million to buy better baked bean treasures or build a bigger museum. He came into the railway station with me, right onto the platform, saying he would wait with me till my train left, as if he didn't quite believe that I was going back to London, and that really I secretly lived in Port Talbot all the time. I thanked him for all his time and help, and told him I thought his little museum was a gem. I had perhaps come slightly to scoff and mock, thinking it might all be nonsense, but I really thought it was a worthwhile, if rather unusual, topic. He'd made a good fist of it, creating something out of nothing. It made me think that opening my own little museum, showing my collections, might not be so silly or unrealistic after all. But I don't think I would ever open a museum in my own home, let alone my own bedroom. My wife would not be at all amused. She gets cheesed off as it is with my clutter all over the place, having strangers walking round the house, making inane and fatuous comments. I had a tin of those, only bigger. Oh, so you haven't got the full set. That would really cheese her off. Cheese? I bet there are loads of cheese museums. But I think one comestible museum is enough. So, what about the future of Captain Beanie's museum? As he is a single man, what will happen to it all? I would hate it all to be chucked in a skip when I die, which is possible. My fantasy is that a local museum in South Wales might accept it, put some of the items on display, that's my hope. But whatever happens, collecting the stuff has given me such a lot of interest and pleasure. When I go, I have left instructions that I want to be buried in a coffin shaped like a baked bean can, and my inscription will read, "Been there, done it, got the museum." Baked Bean Museum of Excellence, 6 Flint House, Moorland Road, Sandfields Estate, Port Talbot, West Glamorgan, SA 12, 6JX. Telephone 01639 680-896. www.bakedbeanmuseumofexcellence.org.uk. Chapter 5. The Casbah and the Beatles. Liverpool. The large, imposing house, number 8 Hayman's Green, was much as I remember it, even though I was last here over 40 years ago. Detached Victorian villa with 15 bedrooms and 1 acre of garden in a very quiet residential road in the suburb of West Derby, about 4 miles from the centre of Liverpool. At one time, it had housed the local Conservative Association. It had looked rather neglected in 1967, with the garden overgrown, a bit mysterious and forbidding. Perhaps a haunted house, kept a bit scary to frighten away kids or intruders. It still looks rather ill-kempt, though I couldn't see much. The trees in the front garden have grown huge and obscure the front of the house, so you can see little of it from the road. I went through the gate and down the driveway to the left of the house, stepping carefully as someone appeared to have been at the drive with a pneumatic drill and left jagged slabs of concrete sticking up. At the end of the drive, I noticed an expensive-looking Jaguar that had managed to get through. As I approached the front porch, which was peeling and chipped, 2 fierce-looking dogs rushed out to greet me. In 1967, I was working on a biography of the Beatles, and was desperate to get into this house. It was the family home of Pete Best, the drummer who had been ditched in August 1962, after 2 years of playing with them in Liverpool and Hamburg, his place to be taken by Ringo, just at the moment when they were about to conquer the known world. His mother, Mona Best, had at first refused to see me, saying that, as my book was going to be the authorised biography, I would be taking their side, and she was still furious with them for what they had done to her Pete. I said I would not be taking sides, just trying to tell the truth. I desperately needed to hear what happened from Pete himself. No chance. Pete was giving no interviews. He didn't want to have anything to do with anyone connected with the Beatles after what they did to him. In the end, though, she agreed to see me herself. I was very pleased, because I knew that Mona had figured highly in the Beatles' saga. As all true believers now know, which means millions all over the world today, though in 1967 there were not many who knew anything at all about her. It was in this large, rambling house that Mona had opened a little coffee club, which she called the Casbah, in August 1959. The Quarrymen, as the Beatles were then, played there as the opening live group, and later, when they had become the Beatles, performed many times over a period of 2 years. By this time, her son Pete had joined them as their drummer, till the axe fell. I remember we sat in a large upstairs room, and she glared at me for a long time before agreeing to answer any questions. She was a very attractive but formidable woman, small, rather olive-skinned. She had been born in 1924 in Delhi, where her father was in the army, and brought up with servants. She married an army officer, John Best, had 2 sons, Peter and Rory, both born in India in 1941 and 1944, and then after the war they all returned to Liverpool. The Best family had for many years owned the Liverpool Stadium, famous as a venue for boxing and wrestling, and John Best became a boxing promoter. He did quite well, but not well enough to move from a smallish house to this vast villa. The legend in the family was that Mona had spotted the house for sale, set her heart on it, and without telling her husband, pawned her jewellery and put the money on a horse called Never Say Die in the 1954 Derby, which came in first. It was thanks to this money that they were able to buy the house. In 1959, Mona's 2 teenage boys were into pop music, which she encouraged as she liked it herself. She happened to see a TV programme about the Two Eyes coffee bar in Soho, where the early skiffle groups and embryo rock bands were playing, and thought Liverpool should have one. She bought an espresso coffee machine, the first in Liverpool, so she claimed, and decided to clean up the cellars under her house, which had been unused and were full of junk, and open a coffee club for the local teenagers. She called it the Casbah, after hearing Charles Boyer utter the line, "Come with me to the Casbah," in a film called Algiers. It also sounded suitably exotic, in keeping with her own Indian background. She told me all this as we chatted. After about an hour, I asked again if I could possibly see Pete sometime. She said, "He's here. He's been listening in the next door room." Pete sheepishly emerged, wearing a white, dusty coat. He had just finished shift work in a bread factory, slicing bread for £18 a week. He sat down, sighed, clearly not really wanting to talk about the Beatles and what had happened. But he did, slowly and patiently. On the 15th of August, 1962, Pete and Neil Aspinall, the Beatles' roadie who lived at Pete's house, had said to John that they would pick him up the next day in the van as usual for their next engagement. John said, "Don't bother," he had made other arrangements. It seemed odd to Pete, but not remarkable. The next day, Brian Epstein called Pete in and told him the news. The Beatles wanted him out and Ringo in. Pete asked why. Brian muttered something about George Martin, with whom they had had their first audition, thinking Pete wasn't a good enough drummer. He had been good enough for 2 years in Hamburg and Liverpool, so why were they doing this now? But that was it. They went on to fame and millions, and Pete went on to, well, nothing very much. Hundreds of Beatles fans had protested in 1962 when the news came out, holding placards, some blaming John, others blaming George, who got a punch in the eye during one demonstration. Pete had been very popular, as all the contemporary accounts reported, described as the handsome one, if very quiet and retiring. A few weeks later, back in London, I was with the Beatles. I told them about the people from their past, whom I had seen in Hamburg and Liverpool. When I mentioned I'd seen Pete, and said he was now slicing bread, they all fell silent, then changed the subject. Sometime afterwards I was with John, on his own, at his house, and he brought up the subject again.
"We were cowards when we sacked him. We made Brian do it. But if we had told Pete to his face, it would probably have ended in a fight."
What I didn't know that day I saw Pete in 1967 was that some time after the sacking, he had been so depressed that he tried to commit suicide, turning on the gas fire in a locked room at Hayman's Green. Fortunately, he was discovered in time by his brother Rory. I also didn't know that day, though John Lennon later told me, sniggering but swearing me to secrecy, that at the time of the sacking, Mona, aged 38, who had been separated from her husband for some time, had just given birth to another son, Rogue. And the father was Neil Aspinall, then aged 20. It gave an extra emotional element to the whole drama, though no one outside the family circle knew at the time, nor in fact for many, many years. Mona died in 1988. Neil went on to be the head of Apple and died in 2008. I never knew what happened to Pete afterwards, though he did write his memoirs in 1985. So I had a lot of catching up to do when Pete eventually appeared. He doesn't live in the house anymore, but nearby. He looked very fit for his age, lean and healthy, good head of grey hair, neat moustache, and seemed confident and happy, more so than he had done 40-odd years ago. After the dead-end bakery job, he joined the civil service. Like John, Paul and George, but not Ringo, Pete had passed the 11-plus exam for grammar school and had gone to Liverpool Collegiate, where he had passed 5 O-levels. He started at the bottom as a clerk and worked his way up to training manager, taking early retirement in 1993. And then he went back to drumming, after playing at an anniversary event to celebrate 30 years since the Casbah had first opened, which had attracted huge crowds, encouraging him to start his own group, the Pete Best Band. It is still going strong, making records and performing around the world. These days, he says, they try to limit their tours to 5 weeks and to be away for no more than 5 months a year. They play heavy rock and roll, not skiffle, anywhere from clubs with audiences of 200 up to open-air stadiums in front of 25,000. Also in the Pete Best Band, and also on drums, is Rogue Best, his half-brother, son of Neil, now aged 47. Smaller, stockier, and bearded, more outgoing and extrovert than Pete. Rogue acts as manager of the band and of Pete. The house still belongs to the Best family, to the three brothers, left to them when their mother Mona died. Rogue, like Pete, lives elsewhere, but one of Rogue's sons lives in the house, as do various other people. Upstairs they have a recording studio and editing suite, and people who work there usually doss down in the house. It did have a bit of a feeling of a 60s squat. One room is the office for the Pete Best Band, and also the office for the Casbah Coffee Club. Yes, it is now open again, this time as a museum. It was Rogue who thought of it, incensed when he was walking down Matthew Street in Liverpool one day and saw notices saying, "Welcome to the Cavern Club, home of the Beatles." The original Cavern Club, which is where the Beatles went on to appear, was demolished in the 1970s, at a time when the city authorities didn't seem to be interested in, or even aware of, the tourist gold mine on their doorstep. The cavern was later rebuilt, but not on the same site.
"So it's not genuine for a start, nor was it the home of the Beatles," says Rogue. "The Casbah Club, if anywhere, was their home. They played here as the Quarrymen and then came back later for their first performance in Liverpool as the Beatles. In all, they played here about 40 times. This is where it all happened, This is the place that really matters. I couldn't let the cavern get away with that statement. You know what happens. If something gets repeated enough times and nobody counters it, it becomes a fact.
Rogue and his brothers and family started clearing out the cellars, which had not been used as a club since the 24th of June, 1962, the Beatles having been the last group to perform there before Mona closed it. Since then, they had been used for storage. They opened 3 years ago, and now have a rather swish website, and each year attract between 5,000 and 10,000 visitors. Bookings are by appointment only, with everyone getting a guided tour, usually with either Rogue or his brother Rory. They want to keep it an intimate, family affair. Rogue and Pete took me down the stairs to give me a conducted tour together. The public today, as in the past, enter from the back garden, which leads into the cellars at ground level. They run the whole length of the house, and are far more extensive than would appear from the outside. The first room is a cloakroom, where membership cards were shown, for Mona was very strict and coat tickets were taken. So popular was the club that they quickly had to have two cloakrooms, one for the girls upstairs. On the wall, on the right, as you enter, are the large, white-painted letters CCC for Casbah Coffee Club, and a large insect covering the whole wall. It's rather clumsily painted and hard to make out if it's a spider or a beetle. Naturally, Rogue likes to believe it is a beetle, though when the club opened, the quarrymen were some way away from changing their name. Mona had hired them a few weeks before the opening night, when the club was still not quite ready, so all of them were given paintbrushes and told to start painting the walls and ceilings. In the second, much bigger room, which they call the Aztec Room, John was made to paint the ceiling 3 times. First of all, he covered it in hideous figures, pot-bellied men, crippled women, children with 3 arms, the sort of crude cartoon figures he was doing for his own amusement at the local art school. Mona was furious, and made him paint over them and start again. This time he did the whole ceiling in green. Mona didn't like that, either. She said she wanted something African or Aztec. John covered the ceiling with lots of little patterns, thinking perhaps of the decoration on an African warrior's shield, which he'd probably seen in a boy's comic. This time, Mona approved. Low down on the right-hand wall, which is wood-panelled, you can clearly see that someone has carved the name John. Mona was furious when she saw it and gave John a slap, but it was too late to remove it. The wood had just been newly installed and painted in black, and she didn't have time to start again as they were working against the clock to get everything ready in time. She also discovered at the last moment that John had done some of his painting work in gloss, not emulsion, as he had been told. Being unable to see much without his glasses, he had picked the wrong pot. Mona was in a panic that it would still be wet on opening night, but it dried in time. The third room is where the quarrymen played on that opening night. It's hard to believe they could have stood up in here, never mind play. It's little more than a corridor, just over 5 feet in width. But of course they didn't have a drummer or a drum kit that evening. This room is now called the Rainbow Room, as the ceiling was painted by Paul in a rainbow pattern. Next door is a much bigger room, which became the band room when the club grew more popular, and the Beatles, when they returned, had a proper drummer, namely Pete. Lots of well-known local groups played here apart from the Beatles, including Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, with whom Ringo used to play in Liverpool and Hamburg in the same clubs as the Beatles, which is where he got to know them. Rory Storm was very tall, around 6'3", and you can still see the hole in the ceiling that he made while jumping up and down too enthusiastically. In this room there is another carving by John, on the ceiling this time, which says, "John, I'm back." The Beatles' first spell at the Casbah, while still calling themselves the Quarrymen, ended in a row. Mona was paying them £3 a session, which meant 15 shillings each for John, Paul, George, and their fourth member at the time, Ken Brown. One evening, Ken arrived feeling ill, so Mona offered him a bedroom upstairs to rest in. When the time came to pay the band, She paid the three who had played 15 shillings each, and also gave Ken his 15 shillings. They maintained the three of them should have shared the £3. It ended in a row, and they stormed out, threatening never to return. Sometime later, when they got their